Chapter 19. Cook. For yourself, your friends, your family. Which brings us to our final question. How did all these pathways change in the last 40 years? Why are addiction and depression today the number 5 and 6 diagnoses, just behind the various diseases of metabolic syndrome, heart disease, hypertension, type 2 diabetes, cancer, that are numbers 1 through 4? Maybe it's because people who think they aren't exposed to something actually are? And maybe that exposure is the same across the country and regardless of class? Or around the world? There are many causes, but the one we haven't yet addressed is the one that is currently affecting almost everyone in the world, regardless of class. And what if that exposure is mixed into all of our food without our knowledge? And what if that exposure just happens to be addictive? What's the cheapest pleasure? Of course, the answer is sugar, the other white powder. Now, you're thinking, great, I made it all the way through this entire book, and Lustig is bringing up sugar again. But it's true. Sugar isn't just responsible for many of our physical health problems, but it also plays a significant role in our mental health as well. Let me prove it to you. Sugar is the stealth ingredient that's been added to virtually every industrial recipe to make processed food palatable and ultimately saleable. As I described in Chapter 6, sugar fulfills the criteria of a substance of abuse, as it is toxic and addictive. It also meets criteria for regulation, as it is ubiquitous, can't get away from it, and detrimental to society. If most of the food in the grocery store is spiked with added sugar, and you don't know because there are 56 names for sugar on the label, and you don't know them, then how do you avoid it? And if the fiber is removed from fruit to turn it into juice, yet no sugar is added, can you even trust the label? And if its biochemical properties fry your liver, and its hedonic properties fry your brain and make you want more, how do you keep from succumbing? Sweetening the pot. The American Heart Association has argued for a daily limit of 6 teaspoons of added sugar for adult women, 9 teaspoons per day for adult men, 3 to 4 teaspoons for children, and none for toddlers below the age of 2. The World Health Organization and the USDA are more lenient, declaring 12 teaspoons of added sugar per day the maximum. However, American adults today consume an average of 19.5 teaspoons of added sugar per day, and children consume an average of 22 teaspoons per day. Latinos, African Americans, and Native Americans consume between 25 and 50% more than their Caucasian counterparts. These minorities are at greater risk for developing metabolic syndrome due to their added sugar consumption, especially from soft drinks. And we know that these same minorities are higher risk for mortality when they manifest severe mental illness. But of course, this is all correlation, not causation. Here's the conundrum. What if we decided to cut down our personal sugar consumption? What if we consciously removed sodas, candy, cakes, and ice cream? Everything we normally call dessert, from our homes and from our diets. Turns out we'd still be over our limit, because only 51% of the sugar in our diet is in foods that you'd expect. That means that 49% of the sugar we consume is in foods and drinks we didn't know had sugar. Salad dressing, barbecue sauce, hamburger buns, hamburger meat, as well as so-called healthy options like granola and muesli. And don't get me started on the health benefits of fruit juice, which is just basically sugar without the fiber. You're still at risk for diabetes. So even if you cut out dessert, you'll still be over your limit because of the rest of the sugar that's in processed food. The industry argues vociferously that sugar is a required and necessary ingredient in their recipes. Here are a few of the industry's pro-sugar arguments and why it's good for them and bad for you. 1. Sugar adds bulk. Did you ever wonder why Lucky Charms has marshmallow stars, hearts, moons, and clovers? Because kids like them? Well, yeah. But really, because marshmallows are cheaper than oats. By taking up space in the box, the industry saves money on oats and can sell the box for more. Great business strategy. 2. Sugar makes food brown. This is why bananas brown and why we paint barbecue sauce on our ribs on the grill. It's called the Maillard or browning reaction. Well, that reaction is happening inside your cells all the time, and when it does, two things happen. Proteins unravel and free radicals form, which further damages cells. The Maillard reaction has another name, the aging reaction. Every time this reaction occurs, it throws off an oxygen radical, which is similar to hydrogen peroxide. It's great for killing bacteria on your skin, but it also kills liver cells, which is why so many people who have fatty livers progress on to cirrhosis. And fructose causes that aging reaction to occur 7 times faster than glucose. Your body, and especially your liver, is aging faster with sugar, just like it does with alcohol. Not good for your physical or mental health. 3. Sugar raises the boiling point. This allows for caramelization to occur, which is very tasty, but again, this is just the Maillard reaction, which over time causes your cells to age. Now, there are data to suggest that fructose could caramelize your hippocampus, which could remove the brakes from your dopamine transmission, squashing your PFC, your Jiminy Cricket. 4. Sugar is a humectant, that is, it attracts and maintains moisture. How soon does fresh bakery bread become stale? Maybe 2 days? How about grocery store commercial bread? More like 3 weeks. Ever wonder why? In commercial bread, the baker adds sugar to take the place of water, known as water activity, because sugar doesn't evaporate. It takes up space in the bread, and the sugar molecules hold on to water during baking so that the bread stays moist. Furthermore, the sugar will attract water from the air so that the bread won't dry out after it's baked. Good for the industry, bad for your health. 5. Sugar is a preservative. Have you ever left a soda at room temperature open to the air? Of course, after the carbonation escapes, it goes flat. But do bacteria or yeast ever grow in it? Never. The question is whether the hit to your liver provided by each dose of sugar is worth the eventual decline in physical health, risk for disability, and increased medical costs. The answer is in. Sugared beverages alone account for 180,000 deaths per year worldwide, and for about 10% of all disability-adjusted life years. And this is especially true in the 20 to 45-year-old age group, which is experiencing rates of disability like never before. And some of that disability is mental health, linked to sugar consumption. A little less sweet. My UCSF metabolic team recently completed a study where we took 43 children, Latino and African American, aged 9 to 19 with metabolic syndrome, and who consumed at least 50 grams of sugar per day. We studied them on their baseline diet for various aspects of metabolic health and fat in different organs. We catered their meals for the next 9 days to have the same caloric content, the same percentage of protein, fat, salt, and carbohydrate as their usual diet. The only difference was that we substituted starch, or glucose, for the added sugar, which was glucose plus fructose, in their diet. We took the sugar in their diet from 28 to 10% of calories, keeping everything else the same. We substituted bagels for donuts, baked potato chips for sweetened yogurt, and turkey hot dogs for chicken teriyaki. Now, we didn't give them good food. We gave them processed food, but without all the added sugar. We also gave them a scale to take home, and each day they weighed themselves. If they were losing weight, we counseled them to eat more in order to keep them weight stable. At the end of 9 days of eating our food, we studied them again. Guess what? Every aspect of their metabolic health improved significantly after just 10 days of eating the lower sugar meals. Their subcutaneous or big butt fat did not change after all. They had not lost weight. But their visceral fat, their big belly fat, dropped, and more importantly, their liver fat dropped a lot. Their blood lipids, markers of heart disease risk, all improved, and in just 10 days. We improved their metabolic health and quality of life without changing their weight. And most importantly, they all felt better. They had more energy, they could concentrate better, and anecdotally, the parents said that they were less disruptive in class. So, what about mental health? Is the acute buzz from each soft drink worth the eventual negative impact on mood? In preschoolers, sugared beverage consumption correlates with behavioral problems. In teenagers, sugared beverage consumption correlates with violence, severe depression, and suicidal thoughts. Studies in Australia and China show that sugared beverage consumption correlates with unhappiness independent of chronic disease development. Furthermore, a study of pregnant Norwegian women found a direct relationship between sugared beverage consumption and loneliness. Of course, these studies are all correlational, not causational. These studies do not clarify whether soda can make you lonely, depressed, and violent, or whether lonely, depressed, and violent people are more likely to drink soda or eat Ben and Jerry's as their reward. Stepping down from the food high. There are at least three reasons to eat: hunger, reward, and stress. Within our mindfulness study, our UCSF reward eating team examined how obese women's reward system drives their food intake toward problem foods and whether stress heightens the reward response to specific foods. We found that 1/3 of the obese subjects in our study reported times when they experienced a loss of control over their eating. And when they did, they gravitated to highly palatable, such as high-sugar, high-fat foods. The question was, could a mindfulness-based intervention reduce both their stress and their food cravings in order to improve their metabolic health and their mental health? Well, first we needed to determine who these subjects were. Our UCSF reward eating team developed and tested the reward-based eating drive, or RED scale. We also found that reductions in reward-driven eating predicted the success of a mindfulness-based weight loss program. Other studies have shown that obese people exhibit a loss of dopamine receptors, or tolerance, in the reward pathway. These data implicate both dopamine and the endogenous opioid peptide systems in this type of reward-based eating drive. The next thing we needed was a biomarker or a lab test of reward-based eating, something that would inform both the subject and us that the reward system was in overdrive and at the root of their eating behaviors. We already knew that some people who were exposed to a drug called naltrexone, which blocks the opioid receptors in order to block the consummation of the rewarding behavior that we discussed in Chapter 3, would often become nauseated and reduce their eating, particularly of sweet, high-fat foods. But it would not alter the consumption of regular foods such as protein, fruits, and vegetables. Naltrexone, or Revia, is a cheap, safe compound that can damp down the reward system of drug addicts, but does relatively little in everyone else. A subset of our subjects took one naltrexone pill to acutely block the reward system. We noted that those who scored highest on the RED scale at baseline were the ones who developed nausea in response to the naltrexone, suggesting that these subjects had the highest baseline opioid function. In another study, we found that obese women highest on that RED scale had the largest reductions in food craving intensity after taking the naltrexone pill. In these series of studies, we found that people with the highest reward-driven behavior were the most responsive to our blocking of the reward system. Therefore, we were pretty sure we had found a probe to study the biology of food addiction. Lastly, we needed to find out whether we could affect this system with a behavioral intervention, such as mindfulness, that reduces food cravings and stress. We followed these subjects through their diet and exercise interventions, either with or without the mindfulness intervention. Perhaps it shouldn't be surprising that those who received the mindfulness eating and stress intervention, rather than the more general intervention that didn't focus on reward-driven eating, experienced large reductions in their reward-driven eating, and that these reductions in reward-driven eating led to weight loss. What's more, it was really about the reductions in reward-related eating, not the reduction in stress, that were the key to weight loss. What was interesting was that these vulnerable people with their broken reward systems showed these improvements more so in the meditation condition when they got the extra training to improve their mindfulness. So, to summarize this series of experiments, we showed that 1. Not everybody with obesity is the same. 2. Some people experience a loss of control with certain foods. 3. Those that do tend to binge on high-sugar, high-fat foods like chocolate cake. 4. This aberrant eating behavior is driven by dysfunction of the reward system. 5. The stress system piles on to disinhibit cognitive control of food intake. 6. Blockading the reward system unmasks both the reward and the stress systems. And 7. Mindfulness can restore functionality to the reward and stress systems, leading to improved mood, less disordered eating, and less risk for metabolic syndrome. So, here's the question. Let's say you're one of these sugar-addicted people. Maybe you employ lots of restraint to stay away from the obvious triggers: soda, cakes, ice cream. But you still have to eat. And what if your food has sugar mixed or baked right into it and you don't know it? Can you break an addiction if the addictive substance is so pervasive that it's in everything but you don't know it's there? Then on top of the added sugar, go ahead and reduce the other two molecules from Chapter 9 that increase contentment, tryptophan and omega-3 fatty acids. Tryptophan is very low in processed food because protein sources of tryptophan are relatively expensive. Omega-3 fatty acids are even more expensive and tend to provide a fishy odor to food. Processed food is high sugar, low tryptophan, low omega-3s. Great for reward, but risky for both addiction and depression. Winning the battle against big sugar. This, my friends, is the explanation for America's and the world's love affair with processed food. By slowly adding sugar, not just to desserts, but to diet staples and condiments as well, the food industry has been able to hook us and keep us hooked. The fat and the salt, while not addictive themselves, serve to increase the salience of the added sugar. Then, of course, add the second legal addiction, caffeine, to soft drinks, energy drinks, coffee beverages, and the like, to provide the second hook. The bitterness of the caffeine is more than offset by the sugar. Plus, caffeine increases the salience or rewarding properties of sugar. Two addictions, and it's all completely legal because sugar and caffeine are both generally recognized as safe, or GRAS, by the FDA. That means the processed food industry is allowed to use any amount it wants in any food it chooses with no repercussions. This designation of GRAS is the least policed administrative law in all of Washington. The GRAS determination provides the underpinning for the success of the entire processed food industry. This is how and why the processed food industry changed our food supply 40 years ago and why we've gotten sick and unhappy ever since. and it's why every country that has adopted our food supply has suffered the same fate. Even the U.S. Government Accountability Office says that grass is dangerous as a designation, and lawyers are starting to call for the revocation of sugar's grass status, similar to how trans fats were removed from the grass list. A group of doctors, lawyers, and entrepreneurs in San Francisco have started a nonprofit organization called Eat Real, eatreal.org, to reverse diet-related disease by changing the global food supply. One of our long-term goals is to get sugar removed from the FDA's grass list, and I am proud to serve as chief science officer. The good news is that after decades of tallying record profits right up until 2012, the soft drink and fast food industries all of a sudden aren't doing so well. McDonald's, Coca-Cola, and Pepsi consistently outperformed the S&P 500 for the previous three decades. In 2014, Mukhtar Kent, then CEO of Coke, with declining profits, announced the firing of 18,000 employees, although the savings was going to be plowed back into advertising, especially to children. And in 2015, Don Thompson, then CEO of McDonald's, was fired for poor performance. British sugar company Tate & Lyle lowered expectations on 2015 profits due to declining sugar demand. Some companies have recognized the problem and are trying to get ahead of and even take advantage of this global trend of sugar reduction in processed food. For instance, in the Netherlands, the grocery chain Albert Heijn has pledged to reduce the added sugar in hundreds of their store brand grocery items, including yogurt, cookies, custard, and ketchup. Furthermore, in response to the global obesity and diabetes epidemics, several countries have examined the research themselves. They are working to oppose the entrenched food industry lobbyists, and some have enacted a sugar excise tax on soda and junk food to get people to reduce consumption by reducing effective availability. Thus far, Mexico and the UK have enacted such a tax, while Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, India, and even Saudi Arabia are considering similar legislation. Closer to home, we've seen six American cities, San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, and Albany, California, as well as Chicago and Philadelphia, enact sugar taxes to generate money for programs and reduce consumption. No information on changes in health or happiness from any of these governmental maneuvers as of yet. But, not surprisingly, there is quite a bit of pushback both from the lobbyists and from the people who feel that this falls strictly within the realm of personal responsibility. But does it? In other countries around the world, sugar consumption within soft drinks and processed foods is on the rise because of lax rules, and just like what happened to tobacco. Once America started tightening the screws on cigarette availability and use, tobacco companies moved offshore in an effort to addict new populations. And in these countries, the sugar beverage industries have a leg up because people have to drink, but they don't trust their water supplies. And who provides the water purification apparatus for most third world nations? You guessed it. Coca-Cola. Sugar propaganda. The food industry has kept us off balance for years by deflecting criticism with its common sense yet fallacious refrain, a calorie is a calorie. It's the quantity of those calories, not the quality, they say. This has been the core of its business strategy for at least 50 years. My public policy colleagues at UCSF have unearthed industry documents dating back to 1965 that show that the Sugar Research Foundation, which was the PR arm of the sugar industry, paid two scientists a handsome sum, $50,000 in today's dollars, to publish two reviews in the New England Journal of Medicine that exonerated sugar and pinned the blame for heart disease on saturated fat. Furthermore, they also showed that in 1971, the corporate suspects infiltrated the NIH agenda to steer research on dental cavities away from sugar reduction and instead to promote a vaccine that never materialized. The food industry continues to put its thumb on the scales of objectivity, both figuratively and literally. 5 out of 6 studies funded by the industry show no effect of sugared beverages on weight gain, while 10 out of 12 studies by independent scientists show a clear effect on weight gain. More recently, Coca-Cola was exposed in paying off 3 scientists to form the Global Energy Balance Network to pin the blame for the obesity epidemic on a lack of exercise. In fact, the soda industry has given away a total of more than $120 million to 96 separate public health organizations to promote anything but food industry regulation. The processed food industry has another trick up its sleeve as well: redefining portion size. Consider processed peanut butter. If you spread a bagel with peanut butter, a standard serving is 2 tablespoons containing 188 calories with 3 grams of sugar. Very few people use only 2 tablespoons for a PB&J. Yet Nutella, in a battle for stomach share of peanut butter gorging kids everywhere, and in an attempt to undercut its competition, successfully argued that it should be reclassified as a jam rather than as a peanut butter, and so its portion size should read lower, at only 1 tablespoon with only 100 calories, half as much as their competitor. Nutella is hoping you'll miss the 10.5 grams of added sugar. Worse yet, our processed food diet has been engineered by the food industry to be fortified with all sorts of vitamins, minerals, and a panoply of additives, whatever's trending, like lycopene or flavonoids or resveratrol, supposedly to give us all the nutrients we need. That's the basis of the $121 billion nutraceutical industry. Hey, you need great hair, great skin, perky breasts, and the natural key is bull semen, jojoba, lychee, raspberry ketone, acai berry. You should cleanse, get an enema, juice. There's always a new pop-up clickbait on your internet newsfeed with a miracle cure for being happy and never aging. The FDA doesn't regulate nutraceuticals, and companies don't have to show efficacy. After all, they're food. But you'll never see "What I Did to Be Happy" clickbait articles for the brain biochemical that can lead to happiness, the right kind of real food. At the other end of the spectrum, the diet sweetener industry has argued that a calorie is a calorie means that their products, by providing sweetness without calories, is the better choice and certainly the best choice for those with obesity. Artificially sweetened beverages now account for 1/4 of the global market. Except for one little problem: they don't work. A recent meta-analysis of all the studies substituting artificially sweetened beverages for the full-calorie version showed absolutely no change in weight and displayed a now familiar bias. Those funded by industry showed weight loss, while those conducted by independent scientists showed absolutely no change in weight. Processed food, an experiment that failed. The science is in. Processed food is addictive, can make you extremely unhappy, and may ultimately kill you. Processed food is the exposure you can't escape, because it's everywhere. Except you can, but you have to be mindful of it in order to do it. Washington will never get on board, as protection of American business trumps protection of the American public. So it's up to each and every one of you. Based on the science presented throughout this book, I offer to you my single most important key to happiness: cook real food for yourself, for your friends, and for your family. It's connection, in that you will be sitting down with people you like and maybe even love. It's contribution, because you are making something worthwhile. It's focusing, so it's easier to cope. And, Unless you spike it with something, it's non-addictive. The amount of sugar in processed food far exceeds what you would include yourself. If you use real ingredients, it will be delicious. It's one of the key ingredients to contentment. And real food means low sugar and high fiber. The fiber feeds your microbiome, so your bacteria will be happy as well. You may lose weight, and you will definitely reduce your risk for all the chronic diseases of metabolic syndrome. And you will be sticking it to the companies who are trying to addict you and your family. The problem is that 1/3 of Americans currently don't know how to cook. They've fallen prey to the food industry's endgame. Microwaving is not cooking. It's boiling water. If you don't know how to cook, you're hostage to the food industry for the rest of your life, and unwittingly will pass this on to your children. You can farm out the shopping. There are companies that will buy the real food and deliver it to your door for you to assemble. Similarly, you can farm out the cooking. There are other companies that will dirty their kitchen instead of yours. Getting ahead in life isn't just taking extracurricular classes and joining the debate team. It's actually cooking and, shocker, spending time with each other. Not just at the table looking down at your favorite gadget, but actually engaging in meaningful conversation. There is nothing that will improve your health, your well-being, your achievement, your sense of accomplishment, your sense of community, and the health and happiness of your family as much as cooking for yourself and enjoying a meal with others. It costs time, to be sure, but it saves money, lots of money, both in food costs and in medical bills. Processed food is no different from any other substance of abuse. Technology brings along its attendant multitasking and sedentary behavior and sleep deprivation. You may have fallen prey to any or all of these ploys over the last 40 years. Yet you didn't succumb to any of these rewards because you needed them. Rather, you wanted them. Maybe because everyone else wanted them too, as conformity is its own form of stress. Nonetheless, you bought your way in, just like they planned. Your mother should know. America is home to the corporate consumption complex, but this problem exists all over the world. We stopped being individuals decades ago after the advent of GDP. We're all consumers now. Technology, sleep deprivation, substance abuse, processed food. These are the killers of contentment and the drivers of desire, dependence, and depression. Connect, contribute, cope, cook. Each of these has the capacity to pull you out of addiction by limiting the need for reward, by optimizing the effects of dopamine and reducing cortisol, and lift you out of depression by increasing contentment and the effects of serotonin. None of these strategies are new, although the science behind them is. These are all things your mother told you when you were a kid, when you were still growing. But since then, you may not have had time to adopt or enact any of them, because you've been too busy texting while quaffing a Coke, because the siren call of pleasure is just too great and too immediate. Happiness, our first garden, is our natural birthright, but we've been cheated out of it. In its place has been substituted a garden of earthly delights, and we're all the worse for it. Some pay the ultimate price and slip into the abyss of eternal damnation. But that first garden is right in front of you, just behind the curtain of your own brain. You can re-enter anytime you choose. I've chosen. I suggest you choose now. It's time to reclaim your original garden as your own.